We're talking, should we cancel Oprah after Neverland and R. Kelly's breakdown, all that and more this week on Black Hollywood Lives, The Trend.
You're tuned into Black Hollywood Live, the world's first digital broadcast network devoted entirely to urban entertainment and pop culture. Tune in right now.
Hey. We don't have music at the top of the show anymore.
I know, but at least now the intro is a little hypey.
We got a little hypey. Oh, what's up, everybody? Welcome, welcome, welcome. You are at Black Hollywood Lives, The Trend. I'm your host, Courtney Stewart, and we're missing Daryl Kristen today, but he's out in these LA streets doing something fabulous and wonderful for somebody else. But we got a full house today and lots of things to talk about. Joining me on the panel this week is, of course, your friend, Jesse Janity.
What's up?
We have the lovely Tanisha Laverne Grant back in the building.
Yes, hello everybody. Thank you so much for having me again.
Thank you so much for coming and joining us again. And we have some really special guests in the building today, you guys. They have an awesome film that we're going to discuss in detail, and it's probably going to teach you a little something that you didn't know about, because I had no idea. We had cowboys in South LA, okay? But we have two special guests in the building. We've got Brett Valentine, and we have Mr. Guam Featherstone in the building as well.
Yes, hello. Thanks.
Welcome. So we're going to learn a little bit more about what they are working on, what they worked on, and how you guys can find it and get this information about what was going on in the L.A. city that we all live in. And I had no idea. It was right around the corner.
Okay.
I know.
Right? Only in L.A.
Only in L.A. All kind of stuff happens. But we're going to start off the top with some topics from Jesse. What you got this week?
Well, you all know that we're one to always talk about, hey, did you catch this on Netflix? Are you watching that on Hulu? You know what I mean? Bird Box came out with some crazy numbers for Netflix. Well, we all may like it, but Mr. Steven Spielberg.
Not so
hated it.
Things to say.
Hated it.
Basically, Steven's trying to put some pushback against this, you know, with the Oscar buzz and all this, these award shows coming out. He's saying he's trying to keep, you know, theatrical movies and movies going to the theater versus you watching them at home and having this big box movie happen in a small little TV screen. He says, came out to say, once you commit to a television format, you're a TV movie. Now, to me, Steven, it sounds like you're stuck in Jurassic Park land, and it's time to welcome you to 2019. And maybe that's why those Jurassic Parks in between the first one and the last one were mediocre. So it's time to just kind of wake up. Ready Player One didn't do as well as, you know, we would like for Steven Spielberg to typically do. And he was kind of saying this in comparison to Netflix Mudbound, which did so well.
And see, that's what we're not going to do. We're not going to talk about Mary J. Blige. We're not going to talk bad about Mudbound. That's not happening.
You know, he's saying, great movie, and it deserves an Emmy.
But, really?
Yes.
Really?
He said, but
really,
we're not bringing it over here to the Oscars. This is for big movies. This is for movies in theaters. So what do you guys kind of think?
We got filmmakers in the building
as
well.
Is Steven stuck?
Is he stuck, or does he have a point?
Can we welcome the web?
Yeah, I actually, you know, Steven Spielberg is actually one of my, you know, one of the directors that I've looked up to the most in my development. And he started out in television. He started, that's where he got his start. And that's really where he started getting his style, his camera styles and his techniques. And so for me, I think television has changed so much. And the content that's on TV and streaming companies like Netflix and Amazon, they've really upped the value and the quality. And these are, for me, they're movies on television. You know, you look at something like Game of Thrones, and it's like one of the biggest, longest running movies that you can watch right now on TV. And so I think that line is really starting to blur. I think the line between what is television and what is movie and what is theatrical, I think in the next 10, you know, 15, 20 years, that line is going to be really blurred at this point. Because I think companies like Amazon, Netflix, I mean, Universal is going to start their own, Warner Brothers, Disney. So it's hard to say what television is going to look like in the next 20 years. And so with the awards, I mean, the difference between an Emmy and an Oscar, I think as television blurs, I think those award lines blur, perhaps.
The bottom line is online is the future and the future is now. The patina is wide open for everybody to have an opportunity. And while some people may have over the years thought they were about equal opportunity, well, we live in a day and age where we're really testing whether or not you believe that philosophy. Because for Steven Spielberg to, you know, sit back, who has done movies, Alice Walker's The Color Purple, he started out with that and employed, you know, Oprah Winfrey and Whoopi Goldberg and all this wonderful black talent. Well, black talent is beginning to emerge at light speed because of the online platforms. You know, so it's just like either you're on board or you're not, Steven. So it's just like you have to come to the 21st century. Yeah. That's just where we are with it.
To just play devil's advocate, though, I do see what he was talking about, where he's talking about the consistency of getting people off their couches, out of their homes, and into a movie theater. And
changing of the guard. It's a changing of the guard.
But there could be a difference there. I mean,
but so
I think
because you can do that, would you say that it makes it more Oscar worthy? Because you're getting people to get up out of their seat?
I think perhaps, I'm not sure. I mean, the way that I saw his, because I watched the interview where he talks about that. And he might be talking about, he might just be suggesting we're talking about apples and oranges here. Right. We're talking about just the mediums by which people are watching these things. And should they be exclusive? Should they be different? Or should they just all kind of be the same? Maybe that's where he's going with it.
Would you guys be game for another category at the Oscars for streaming films?
I think maybe for right now because it's new and to move it into it. But, I mean, honestly, there are some – now, don't get twisted, Netflix. Y'all are picking up a few too many movies because I'm like, we could have put this budget elsewhere. Because when you watch a movie like Bird Box that had me, you know, so drawn into it, or Mudbound, like these are – they're you watch it and you're like – I might as well go into the movie theater, you know, to watch it. I'm not. I felt like he's talking about like how you brought up Game of Thrones, and it's like that's a television series, but a movie is a movie. You know, I didn't watch Blackbird and say, "Wow, this is a great TV, a Hallmark movie." You know what I mean? Like, it, cinematically, it was amazing. Like for what they did, and I just am like, brah.
Yeah, I think if it's creative brilliance, it's creative brilliance, and it deserves to be nominated for an Oscar, point blank, period. Yeah. Whether you saw it in the movie theater or you saw it on your television screen, like I understand this idea of like getting people to go to the movies, but the reality is, the people that are going to movies and seeing movies, most of those movies aren't nominated for Oscars anyway.
Exactly.
That point.
I don't really buy into that. I don't know. I just feel like it's trying to down a movement that's actually really good for our creative space. And these extra opportunities are giving new voices and new creativity is blossoming. And they're doing some beautiful work. That doesn't mean everything needs to be nominated for the Oscars. But I do think there's space for both to be in
the
that same space.
The floodgates are wide open.
Yeah, but to that point, the floodgates are wide open. I mean, where does it stop then? What about YouTube?
Why does it have to stop?
Yeah, exactly.
Why does it have to stop?
Yeah, because honestly, YouTube I forget what the movie's called, and it was right when YouTube was starting to come out with the thing, but and it was about the end of the world, and they were picking and choosing the kids or whatever. And I was like, for a YouTube? I was like, okay, all right, come on, YouTube.
I think it's just going to be harder.
I subscribe to it.
Yeah, it's just going to be harder for the judges now.
It's like so much
more
content. There's more content.
More content.
That's true. But
I'm glad
I'm
not on the panel.
But if the Oscars are supposed to sort of be this like
inclusive,
but this recognition of some of the highest film art that we put out, then we should be open to all of these spaces that are bringing that art to the table.
Mm-hmm. The Oscars can stay what it is, and somebody can implement a new award show that will be inclusive to the online platforms.
We need no more awards shows. Yes, we do.
Because Spike Lee still did not get Best Picture and Best Director.
True.
So, yeah, we still could use another award show. Jeff Friday, where are you at ABFF Honors? Because, yeah, we still need to make that happen.
Well, one day.
Well, you know? I don't know if you know about one day, but the other day, It was kind of, I mean, we've really had a whole bunch of, it's like the month of February to March has been a box of Russell Stover candy with it. Yes. You love messiness. So Michael Jackson, HBO released this documentary, a two-part series called After Neverland. And on the final part two, Oprah did a sit-down with victims of sexual abuse, and also the two victims from the documentary, Wade Robson and James Safechuck, and then also the director, Dan Reed. Funny note before we get started on this conversation, but I could not stop laughing because Oprah has been calling this documentary Leaving Neverland, and with a big sign behind her that said After Neverland, and every time she refers to it as Leaving Neverland, you see the director just cringe like... But who's gonna check Oprah and be like, oh girl, you're saying the wrong name. So, but Oprah isn't in hot water for that. She's in hot water because a lot of people did not appreciate the fact that Oprah is coming out here, and she, it seemed like because she was doing the interview with the alleged victims that she was kind of picking a side.
Well, she did pick a side.
You know.
Twitter
dragged Oprah.
We need to let Michael go.
They're talking about canceling Oprah, and even though she don't got a show to really cancel, but, you know, they're saying, wow, Gail's doing the R. Kelly story, and look how good she did, and Oprah's over here coming across biased, and, you know, I actually watched it, and I thought... Other than, well, that's so petty. I mean, never mind. I thought Oprah was honest. I like that she reached back into her how many years of journalism and said, hey, I've met with over 200, and I've interviewed over 200 and something victims. And I think a lot of the points she hit, it was 30 minutes too long, but I think a lot of the points she hit in today's standard of what we've been reading in the news, I feel like this was important to have. Now, I hate that it's about Michael Jackson because I am a Michael Jackson fan, you know, and it's whether do we believe Wade Robson? Do we believe James? I mean, to be honest with you, that James man, I mean, just his face alone sold me the story. Did everyone check the, did you guys get a chance to see the documentary?
Yes.
What were your thoughts on it?
Well, my thoughts on it,
what were your thoughts prior and then when you saw it?
Okay, well, prior to it, I grew up in the 70s. Like you said, you're a 70s baby. I'm a 70s baby.
I was born in the 70s, yeah. So let's just speak.
Well, okay. I was born in 1970. So I like to claim all of those years, you know. So, and I was a big Michael Jackson fan, tried to do everything he did, dance like him. And so, but I remember all the allegations that came out about the child abuse and child molestation. Now, I remember watching it as a child, and I was like, oh, that's terrible if he did that. And then I remember Oprah interviewing him as well, and he came on, and he vehemently denied everything that was said, and he could never do it. And I remember thinking to myself as a child, well, I still won't go to Neverland, you know, see, so because it already came out there. So once things are said, perceptions are people believe what they hear, whether it's true or not true. So now, coming up to date, seeing this, these same people come back as adults, and they're saying now, okay, well, we lied as children, you know, we were forced to do it or however they did, and then listening to them, it's a hard pill to swallow because it's like, why would a grown man put himself through all of this humiliation? And, you know, so you start thinking about that. And I really don't know what to believe because Michael isn't here and there was so much time has elapsed, but what I do... See, the problem is that he's dead, first of all, and he's not here to defend the words that are being said against him, and his legacy is out there. And then you have all kind of other people that have passed away, and they have shady past as well. And no one is trying to destroy their legacy. So it's like, okay, what is the point behind this? Is it money motivated? Because justice can't be served. They should have did that while he was living, and they were living, and why didn't you come out with this same type of, you know, energy that you have now while he was living to say, look, I'm an adult now. I want to say I lied. I did this. They had ample time to do that. So that's why I have mixed emotions about it. I just think that right now the message is being put out to the world and everyone's going to have their own perception. They're mm-hmm. So he's not here to defend himself. So of course, like you say, I saw his face, and I can believe it because I saw his face. So, but you weren't there. You know, you don't know what happened. You don't know why he waited 30 years to bring it out, or, you know, so it's a lot of speculation, and I just think it's a sad thing.
Yeah.
Well, as a documentary filmmakers here, obviously you guys have a documentary. What did you think about the idea that the director, what's his name? I just forgot it.
Dan Reed.
A lot of discussion was about not sharing at least some of the other side of what had happened, and that it was very one-sided. It was just those two guys' stories. Obviously not really supported by a whole lot of physical evidence and that kind of thing. So yeah. Do you feel like he had any kind of obligation or should have presented a little more of the other side? Or was he said he was just there to tell their stories and that's it.
Yeah, he said basically that we've already know what the Jacksons are going to say. We've seen movies and heard stories of it. So this was...
I mean, for me, that really does come down to the decision of the filmmaker and what kind of movie that they are trying to make. I ran into this same sort of thing when I was doing Fire on the Hill, where we were talking about The Hill, we were talking about The Hill Stables, and we were talking about how much of an impact that it was making in the community down in South Central L.A. But the place was ragged. It was a mess. It had grandfathered in permitting, and it was so old that the permitting didn't need to be upkept up through the years. And so there was a decision that I was posed with, which is, do we discuss that? Do we bring that up in the film, or do we not? Hmm. And ultimately... I wanted to include it in there because I did want to include the other side. And we went out and we interviewed animal services and all that. And we wanted to get the other side of the coin because ultimately that was fair, that I felt, you know, as a filmmaker. Now, with these two films, or one film that in two parts, you know, I know the filmmakers, they wanted to have it be about the subjects and not about Michael Jackson, but...
It's hard for it not to be about
Michael
Jackson.
He's at the center of it. He's at the center of it.
He's an icon, and, you know, from what I'm sorry. Go ahead.
You're exactly right. That's what I was going to say. He's so intertwined in the story that it seems like there is kind of a void that has been created where I would like to hear... the other side. I think the way that it was cut too, and you saw a lot of the same footage over and over again, mm-hmm. And under lines, and there is you can manipulate footage that way. But again, you know, I kind of default to what he was talking about is like, this is ultimately a film about these subjects. And, you know, as the artist, as the filmmaker, he has every right to have that opinion.
Well, there you go. Right out of filmmaker.
Michael Jackson is such a slippery slope. I mean, I do know he owned the Beatles catalog. He owned, so much of Sony's music. So we know, there's always a conspiracy theory part. But, you know, I do believe in real journalism in terms of Oprah. I think Oprah was a journalist. I don't know if anybody has ever read a book called Tailspin, where Stephen Brill says, and I have the quote here, a journalist takes the obvious, if self-serving, position that their job is to provide accurate information about important subjects and that how the people use or misuse the information is not their responsibility. Mm-hmm. You know, so I really don't think... you know, Oprah should be getting dragged. It's like we live in such a culture where the minute somebody that you love or admire or respect disagrees with your philosophy, you know, you want to have a cancel somebody hashtag. Cancel yourself. Cancel your philosophies and some of the bullshit you get behind. Like, give me a break already. Next week, Oprah will do something fantastic, and it'll be Team Oprah again. Like, get your life together.
Well, it's because of Michael Jackson, right? But if Oprah did this and there was no huge celebrity attached, and it was to talk about sexual abuse, she wouldn't be getting dragged for this. Because I felt like she did a careful job.
She did a careful job, but the timing of it is what I think is the real dragging, because Oprah has such roots in Chicago, and the R. Kelly thing was happening and has been happening for so long, and it never happened with... A lot of the criticism has been that it never happened with black girls. And she is supposed to be this, like, strong black woman, black girl advocate, and so a lot of people came for her because they're like, wait, you'll go after Michael Jackson in this semi-sensationalized sort of situation because this documentary is a little bit, you know, we're not so sure how to take this documentary, but you did not put that same power behind the R. Kelly situation, and you've had years of knowledge of that to have done something. So I feel like the real dragging is not so much just that it was Michael Jackson, but also because this whole R. Kelly thing is sort of underneath that.
Well, maybe Gail got the interview first, and Oprah's like, I ain't gonna hurt, I ain't gonna...
Well, Oprah could have got the interview years ago back in Chicago, but speaking of Gail, we're gonna jump on into that situation, and speaking of journalism, Gail King on CBS This Morning got the coveted interview with R. Kelly. First time he's spoken since all of this has gone down. It's our EUR Web Spotlight story of the week. Yes. So I don't know if you guys got to see any of the interview or see the crazy clips online, because Instagram had the whole interview online before it even aired. Mm-hmm. But he was very, very animated and very, very upset. He was throwing out lots of quotes that people are remembering, like he's fighting for his effing life and that they're trying to assassinate him and that it's all lies and he has never slept with a girl that is underage ever. Yeah, I think he was revealing a little too much about what he's probably doing at home. He's like, nobody's changed. Up like, in my basement. It's like, boom, nobody brought that up. We didn't bring that up. But either way, he spoke. Gail was poised for the entire interview, and people are like, oh my God, she's such an amazing journalist. She's kept her composure. I'm like, but girl, she's composed. She's supposed to be composed.
They were just like, this whole interview was sensationalism. It's like, what do you do? I mean, these are the topics. These are the people that you want to hear about.
These
see,
are people that get right. ratings so and people like, want to hear
about. What did you want Gail to get up and fight him? Like,
I have no idea. But he was, right after the interview aired, he was arrested and he is back in jail for not paying child support.
Now, $161,000. I'm interested to see if another black woman is going to bail his ass out.
They probably will.
He got pulled into questioning because of this whole thing.
Yeah, I'm sure he will get bailed out again by somebody. But apparently, if it's over $20,000 of child support due, it is a felony. He owes $161,000. So that is not good for his life. Do you guys feel like that interview should have been done at all?
I feel he should have stayed, huh? Yeah. Whoever told him to go there, he needs to slap him. That was the worst thing he could have ever did.
Then the girls did it, and then now you just hear because Gail went on, and I'm excited. I am going to watch it. They're going to release the
tomorrow
full
morning. The girls, the interview with his two girlfriends will also air.
No, they're going to drop the whole 80 minutes with R. Kelly. But the fact that then Gail came on, she was like, he was there behind the girls and he would cough so that they would know that he was there. Like, bro, you are not helping your story in any way.
That's insane.
Not at all.
R. Kelly is sick. Is he sick?
Not to change.
Don't bring off the hands.
It's not funny, but R. Kelly is a sick individual.
It's true.
He is sick, and we'll play it out with somebody that is, he's ill.
Yeah.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
On top of him being a pedophile, he's a classic narcissist. I mean, my God. I mean, it was like watching a third grader not take responsibility for, you know, taking somebody's lunch. It was so bad, and what he's done is just so vile, so dark, so dastardly. Mm-hmm. And for him to get up, you know, on national television like that and just really make a mockery of, you know, those young women that he abused just so is so sickening. It's just it was hard to watch. It was hard to watch.
Welcome to American Morning Show Television.
It was honestly
apparently it was must-see TV.
It was like, and then to tie it into what Oprah was talking about and how, like, because you look at these two girls and how manipulated they are.
Yeah.
And it's exactly like, what's his name? James said, you know, I'm coming out here, I'm doing this interview about Michael. And he said, I still like have this feeling of like guilt. Like, oh, I'm hurting Michael by doing this, by telling his story. Like he was that manipulated. And you look at these two girls and you're like, they're in it right now. Like, they're not going to really be able to heal for years from now from this. Like, because they are sold.
Next level gaslighting.
Oh, yes.
Next level gaslighting.
Mm-hmm.
Next level gaslighting, man. It's just...
Well, Azriel and Joycelyn, we praying for y'all because I have no idea what else can be done. Their parents have been all over the documentary trying to get them free, and they're obviously where they think they want to be right now. So hopefully one day that will no longer be the case. And hopefully R. Kelly stays in jail. But we're going to move on, and we're just going to give some celebration because after a heavy show and a heavy month and a half of all kinds of, I mean, between Jesse and, all, like, there's just been too much going on. So we're going to celebrate a non-problematic and an amazing, wonderful young man by the name of Jaden Smith.
Yes.
For those of you that don't know, he has been using his own nonprofit organization to continue to bring love and water to the city of Flint, Michigan. And if y'all don't forget, Flint has not had clean water for quite some time. Since before they declared a state of emergency there in 2016, and it was January 2016. So for over 3 years, at least on a federal level, we have clearly known these people do not have access to clean water, and they still do not.
And we building a wall.
That's another conversation. But congratulations to Jaden and to his mom, Jada, who is also helping him out for the build. They installed a water filtration system at the First Trinity Missionary Baptist Church over the weekend. People can come, bring their jugs, fill it up with filtered water every Sunday from 11 till, I believe it's 1:30 at the church, and they will be paying for all of the utility expenses and things that come along with that, and hoping to install another filtration system in the near future. So thank you for keeping the light on Flint, because otherwise we probably would not be talking about Flint at all still, and those people would just still be suffering.
Go
so
Jaden.
Shout out to Jaden.
Cyrus Smith.
I know. He's doing wonderful things, and also doing wonderful things, like I told y'all at the top of the show, we got two guests up in here that have stories to share that I myself knew absolutely nothing about. Like, I got this clip of Fire on the Hill documentary, and I was like, what is this? Cowboys, what's going on? And I thought it was going to be like Santa Clarita somewhere, whatever. It's South Central LA. There's men on horseback running. I was in shock.
I love
Black Cowboys. I was like, yes, I am excited. So tell us about the documentary and how you guys decided you wanted to tell this story and share it with the world.
So the documentary is called Fire on the Hill. It's about a group of black cowboys in South Central LA. It's really based around this stable, as I mentioned earlier, called The Hill. It's one of the last inner city stables that was down in South LA. I came across it in 2011. Basically, there's a story there, but basically I followed horse manure, and it led to The Hill Stable. And I just was like, everybody, the reactions that I've been, you know, getting that everybody has is like, what is this doing in the middle of the inner city here? And so I just started asking questions and meeting people, and got introduced to Guan. He invited me out on a horse ride. This is back in 2011. So this is when the stable was up, and we were filming, and during the course of the filming, there was a fire there, and it was set really mysteriously, and we talk about that in the film, but we really follow three subjects in the wake of this, Guan being one of them, who is trying to kind of resurrect the hill and bring it back, because it was a place that was doing so much to get kids out of gangs. And it was really using a very unique way to do it, in a way that's actually tied into the history and the heritage of South LA and the black cowboy there. And so, so he's one of the main subjects in it.
Can you share a little bit of your story, how you found your way to the hill? And
I found my way to the hill in 1999. After I came back from Europe, I was in the military, I was in the army, and I needed a place to be. Even though I'm from Los Angeles, Los Angeles had changed so much. Gang banging had just took off. You know, like I said, I'm a 70s baby, so I saw the whole transition when people used to just go to different blocks and we'd fight each other and then pick up sticks and then chains, and then next thing you know, guns came out, and I was gone. I was in the army. And when I came back, it was just so segregated, I didn't really know where to go. And someone told me about this place called The Hill, and I said, okay, let me go try it out. And they had horses up there, and it was like a community within a community. And all these people that were there, they, like, adopted each other like family members. And so I saw that you had Mexicans, whites, blacks, Crips, Bloods, Serranos, all these different gang members in this area, and they were getting along, and it just tripped me out. Like, what is the common denominator here? How is everyone in this little street getting along, but outside of here, people are killing each other because they live on the wrong block? And I purchased a horse for my child. I bought a pony first thing, and then I bought me a horse, and another horse, and another horse. Next thing you know, my whole lifestyle was just up there at that place. It became like an everyday place. Everyone just was adopted family members, and we just got along until the fire came. And then once the fire came and we got closed down, everyone dispersed. So now you have cowboys all over the city. You know, now they're in Riverside and Hesperia. And some horses are in Compton. And so now we're trying to rebuild and get a central hub again, because we noticed that a lot of the children that used to frequent the place, now they went back to the streets. Mm. Mm. They're in gangs. They're in jail. They're dead. And so it was like, man, this, we got to do something. So when Brett came up with the idea to film and make awareness, get some type of awareness out there to get the city involved and try to see if we could get this place built, it was a great idea. We just thought we were just going to do a little clip and, you know, like a support clip. Mm-hmm. And then it turned into what it is. It's now it's Fire on the Hill, and it's a great story, not just because I'm in it. But
it's definitely a great story. When I got the email about Black Cowboys, the first thing I thought about was a film I saw when I was a little girl, directed by Gordon Parks, called Thomasine and Bushrod. Mm-hmm. They were a couple, but they were robbing banks. But, you know, they were Black people on horses, you know. Mm-hmm. And I just remember being so fascinated. And then fast forward to, like, 1992 or 1993, Melvin Van Peebles' Their Posse, you know. So I thought, like, wow, this is really great. And then when I queued in, I'm like, oh, my God, this is a really fantastic narrative and such a wonderful way to get, like, Black youth involved.
Yes.
In, you it know, is. Horses and just, you know, the way life used to be, sometimes just to get away from, you know, the sharp edges of inner city living. So just awesome. And I just really hope it's you guys are able to get something.
It's growing. It really has a ground swell following now. And it's we're getting bigger and bigger. Every festival that we go to, we just went out at Big Sky. We won an award out there. We premiered back in L.A. Film Festival. So we won Best Documentary in the Muse category out there. Mm-hmm. So it's really starting to get a lot of following. We're taking this out on the road. We're going to be in festivals going throughout the year with it. And so, you know, we're hoping to pick it up on for distribution. We're hoping to get it out there on Netflix. Maybe we'll get an Academy Award. Maybe not.
I'll vote.
Not or
Amazon or one of the streamers, or hopefully in theaters too. You know, this is something that I think is a story that is important. It's not only just important for us in this community. It's really a story that's important for I think the country and the world to see, because it's a lot about perceptions and what we perceive. I grew up in Northern California, and I had, you know, just perceptions of South L.A. I grew up, you know, when I was 13 years old, that was when the L.A. riots happened, you know, and I just knew South Central was a place that I didn't want to go and I never wanted to be in. When I went there and I found the hill, it's just these guys defied everything that I was told. And they continued to do that. And so that changed my perception when I went down there. And not only that, but also the rodeo community. This film does a lot to talk about the rodeo community. We have Chris Bird, who's out there, who's a bull rider. He's coming from a legacy of bull riders that are from South L.A. Mm-hmm. The first African-American to ever win the world in bull riding came from Watts, California. Nobody knows this.
Came right out of the hill. Was trained at the hill. Right.
Yeah, Charlie Sampson in 1982.
That's amazing. Wow. Mm-hmm.
So it's not only about perception in South L.A., but it's also about perception in other communities, like the rodeo communities. And so we took two places that seemingly have nothing to do with each other, and this film kind of mixes the two. And I think that's one of the important takeaways, I think, that the film gives to audiences is it's about perceptions and breaking down those perceptions. And that's kind of I think it's an important thing at this time, day and age, when we have so many different you know, metaphoric and physical walls going up, physical walls, and so, you know.
Yes. I mean, and can I add one thing?
Sure.
When we went out to Montana, it was amazing. We went to some schools out there, to some high schools, and then we had interviews with the kids, and the kids, they watched the film, and then after the film, we had like a Q&A session, right? Mm-hmm. And then Brett started it off, and he said, just to break the ice, what is your perception about South L.A., people in South L.A.? The room got quiet. Then we were like, no, go on, talk, it's okay, say something. And then next thing you hear, gangs, drugs, violence, robbery, deception. I mean, anything that they could say bad, it that was their perception of South L.A. Mm-hmm. And then everyone on the panel started talking. The other Cowboys were there, and they started talking and expressing themselves. And then at the end of the expression, someone from the high school said, well, what is your impression of Montana before you came? What was it? And then I was like, well, I just really didn't want to be dragged behind somebody's truck or hanging from a tree. And then the faces dropped. Like, wow. And they were like, well, what is your perception now? I'm like, well, I'm blown away because the people were so friendly. I can move there. You see what I'm saying? But before I went there, I was like, man, we better not be walking down after the movie. We're going straight, get the Uber, going straight to the... We don't want to get caught up. Yeah, but it was total opposite. We were hanging out. The people embraced us. We embraced them. And so the it's an important film. And it's doing things that we really didn't intend it to do, but it's doing it.
Amazing. So how can people find out more information about the film, screenings that may be coming up or anything like that?
Yeah, so we have a Facebook page. You can go visit us on Facebook. It's Fire on the Hill Film on Facebook. We have Instagram, Fire on the Hill. Our website is fireonthehill.la, that where we're going to be posting where we'll be in with festivals. We have one coming up in Northern California, up in Sonoma. At the end of the month, it's a hometown festival for me.
Cool.
More importantly, too, a foundation has started from this, and the Hill Foundation.
Hill Foundation.
And so if you go to hill-foundation.org, you can find out about how to help and support and support these programs that are now just starting as a result of this film.
So it's kind of is the Hill sort of getting back up and running, and
that's
things
what we're
are
in the process
around.
Of.
Yeah,
process
and
of.
It's,
we
it's
physically
working.
Built it, but the organization of everything is happening right now.
So it's coming.
Yeah,
it's coming.
Things are happening. Good things are happening. I don't want to ruin anything in case you know for people to see the film, but you should see the film and. Things are happening.
Yes.
Okay. Nice. One more time. Where is the foundation located?
Hill-foundation.org. That's our website. Log on and check our programs out.
Okay, definitely. All right, guys. Well, where are you guys going to be this week? Jesse?
Well, y'all can hit me up everywhere at DJ Jesse J. And if you love Ratchet Reality TV, make sure you guys check out VH1's Love & Hip Hop The T podcast on Apple Music.
And Ms. Tanisha, where can they find you?
You can find me on a blog that I have on blackinamerica.com. So make sure you click blackinamerica.com. You can also follow me on Instagram and Facebook at Tanisha Laverne Grant, all three names. If you can say Sarah Jessica Parker, you can say Tanisha Laverne Grant. Get your life. Get your life.
You guys, make sure you follow us at BHL Online over all social media. And make sure you follow me at Stuart Starlet. I'll be around doing something somewhere. Thank you so much for joining us. Make sure you guys go look up Fire on the Hill. It's amazing. I'm so excited about it, and support the organization to get them back up and running, because I mean, if we can't do that, like, what we need to do our own Jaden up in LA. You know,
that's
have
right.
a moment, you know what I'm saying? So check out the foundation, and you guys check us out again, because we'll be back here next week.
Bye.
Thank you guys.
All right. Thank you.
On behalf of our BHL staff, we would like to thank you for tuning in to Black Hollywood Live, the world's first digital broadcast network devoted entirely to urban entertainment and pop culture. Check out our Black Hollywood Live YouTube page for even more great programming and amazing content. And be sure to subscribe and like our channel when you do. I'm your BHL host, Nakia Monet, and you can find me on all social media at Kiki Boom Boom or at Black Hollywood Live. Black Hollywood Live, Hollywood redefined.